listeners, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Today's show, If I May, barks up a tree we've not visited in years. We'll be previewing a diverse group of mysteries, true stories, and historical fiction that feature dogs at the heart of the tales. Whether or not one of man's or woman's best friends lives under your roof, who doesn't have a soft spot for our four-legged friends? More than likely, you're familiar with my guest today, W. Bruce Cameron, as the author of the wildly popular A Dog's Purpose several years back. Bruce stops by today to discuss the movie that's now being made of the book and his new title, The Dog Master, historical fiction I think you'll find fascinating. Yup, we're going to the dogs, so let's get right to it as we turn to page one of the book report. Who Let the Dog Out is book 13 in David Rosenfeld's Andy Carpenter series. If you're not yet familiar with these entertaining books, let's discover one of them together now. Lawyer Andy Carpenter is surprised when Willie, Andy's partner at their dog rescue operation, the Tara Foundation, calls to say the alarm has gone off at the foundation building. There's been a break-in. A dog has been stolen. Because the dogs rescued by the Tara Foundation are given collars with GPS tracking, Andy and Willie are confident they can find the missing dog. They follow the signal to a house, and the dog is there, standing next to a dead body. Is the dog theft somehow connected to the killing? Andy finds himself looking into circumstances surrounding the break-in and the dog theft. What he starts to uncover makes him believe the cops have nailed the wrong guy for the crime. Grover Gardner performs the book.
Cheyenne stops barking when she sees me. She is sitting on the floor about 5 feet from a recliner chair in what probably passes as the den, with a leash still around her neck. The room has a sofa, a table with a small TV resting on it, and the chair. In the chair is a dead body. As a criminal attorney, I have seen way more than my share of them, both in photographs and sometimes in person. While I don't make it a practice to rank them, it's safe to say that this is not one I am soon going to forget. The victim looks to be in his 40s, well-built, dressed in jeans and a Syracuse University sweatshirt. My guess would be that he's about 6 feet tall, but it's hard to tell because he's sitting down and mostly decapitated. His throat has been sliced, and his head hangs to the side, only partially connected to his torso. His hands are behind him, probably tied behind the chair, but I'm not about to go back there to find out. No one is going to have to feel for a pulse to know that this guy is history, and establishing time of death is not going to be a problem because before I turn away, I think I can see that the blood is still flowing. It's hard for me to accurately take in the scene because I'm trying to do it while gagging, screaming, and running out of the room. As I'm leaving, Pete and Willie have heard me and are running in. They're going to understand my reaction soon enough. There's no reason for me to stop and explain it to them. I run out on the porch and try to take deep breaths and avoid throwing up. I haven't thrown up since I was a kid, and just the memory of how awful it was makes me want to throw up. I can hear Pete yelling something inside the house, but I can't tell what it is. Moments later, Willie comes out with Cheyenne on the leash, and he hands it to me. "Keep an eye on her," he says, and when I take the leash, he goes back into the house. So I'm left on the porch, simultaneously retching, gasping, panicking, and holding a leash. Fortunately, I'm a multitasker. It's less than 5 minutes before the police cars start to arrive, and there must be 10 of them. Pete comes out to talk to two of the officers. Pete is a captain in robbery homicide, so I assume he's in charge and just consulting. He hasn't said anything to me since we discovered the body, but when he sees me still on the porch, he comes over. "You and the dog should wait over there," he says. "You're going to need to give a statement." "You know everything I know," he nods. "We have to get it all on paper." Then he points to Cheyenne. "Too bad he can't talk." "She." "What?" "She's a female. Her name is Cheyenne." "Thanks," he says with a slight frown. "That's just the kind of information we need." "What's the victim's name?" I ask. According to his driver's license, Gerald Downey. You know him? I don't, and I tell him so. Then, any evidence of a break-in? Pete frowns again. You conducting a formal investigation? Or maybe looking for a client? No chance. My last client was such a pain in the ass, I'm retired. Since Pete was my last client, the dig isn't that subtle. The back door was open. That could have been the point of entry, and it's possible the perpetrator took off that way when we showed up. The wound was very fresh. I noticed, I say. And after our statements, can we take Cheyenne back to the Foundation? He nods. Yeah, I don't see her as a suspect. Maybe you can represent her in a civil suit. Crime scenes take forever to process, and when the crime is murder, then forever understates the case. It's almost 3 hours before Willie and I give our statements and are cleared to leave. Willie has Cheyenne's leash, and he comes over and says, I'm going to take her home with me, just in case. Okay. You get a look at the guy's face? He asks. Not really. Once I saw it wasn't attached to his neck, I didn't really focus on it. I did. He came in yesterday, said he was interested in adopting a dog. Which one, Cheyenne? Willie shrugs. I don't know. It never got that far. I asked him where the dog would sleep, and he said he had a doghouse, so I got rid of him.
We've just heard Who Let the Dog Out by David Rosenfeld. W. Bruce Cameron began his writing career as a humor columnist for the Denver Rocky Mountain News. Sadly, the Rocky went out of business, but Bruce assures us that was not his fault. In addition to the beloved books, Bruce is a versatile author. The TV show, 8 Simple Rules, was based on his book, and he co-wrote a feature film, Muffintop, A Love Story, released in November of last year. Bruce's novel, A Dog's Purpose, spent 52 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's now being made into a DreamWorks film, for which Bruce and his writing partner have written the screenplay. The book's sequel, A Dog's Journey, was published in 2012. Bruce followed that with The Dogs of Christmas in 2013 and The Midnight Plan of the Repo Man in 2014. Yes, that title has a dog on the cover, too. Today we'll speak with Bruce about his newest title, The Dog Master. Welcome, Bruce, and thanks for joining us on The Book Report.
Oh, thank you.
One reviewer has called you, and I quote, an author who understands the canine soul. How did you evolve into that guy?
You know, I didn't set out to be the dog guy, but I wrote this book, A Dog's Purpose, and it took off. And, you know, the market has a way of pushing people in a certain direction. I have always had a dog. I've always loved dogs. And my books started to show up with dogs on the cover because I always put a dog in my books, or I make the books about dogs. And that's the Dog Master, my newest book, is about dogs.
Right. What inspired you to pick up the pen and write about the prehistory of man and dog?
It really was my little dog, Tucker. I mean, he's 25 pounds of scruff, and he's afraid of plastic bags blowing in the wind, and when the UPS man rings the doorbell, he runs into the closet to bark just in case the guy wants to come in the house. He wants to make sure that he's safe in the closet, and yet he has wolf DNA in him. All dogs have wolf DNA. When I read that, I thought that I need to understand how this came together, and the more I read about it, the more preposterous it seemed that man and wolf teamed together. It happened 30,000 years ago. So that's where the Dog Master is set. 30,000 years ago, the very first dog, which was, of course, a domesticated wolf.
All right. So the book is set in, as you say, the Upper Paleolithic era. Give us some background of what was going on at that time.
30,000 years ago, it was not looking good for the human race. There were fewer of us than would fill a decent-sized football stadium. Ice was coming out of the north, and when we think about the glaciers, we're not really able to even understand ice that's almost 2 miles thick coming out of the north. We were dealing with climate change on a horrendous scale. And we were forced out of the trees and out on the plains where there were animals that were fierce compared to today. We're talking about lions that are 40% bigger than today's biggest lions. They had paws the size of a man's head. There was a bear that was the size of an elephant, and it could run 45 miles an hour. These fierce creatures were roaming the plains, and they saw us as being an available meal. We were banded together in these tight, small tribes trying to survive, and another enemy we had was the wolf. The wolves were not the elusive creatures that they are today because we've hunted them. Back in the time of the dog master, wolves would have seen us as being an easy lunch. I realized that there must have been something absolutely extraordinary that happened for us to make friends with these mortal enemies.
How did you begin to research the book, and how long did it take you to research?
When I set out to research the Dog Master, I was totally unprepared for how different life was back then. I knew it was prehistory, and I have to say the science is amazing that so much has come from just looking at bones and dirt, basically, and that is what these people do. They look at bones and dirt and stone, and they put together theories on what it must have been like for people back then, and they were people. The characters in the Dog Master sound a little like us because they were us. They didn't have written language, but they certainly would have had language, and they would have had the same feelings we do because they were modern. They were modern man, if you will. They were not any different looking. They didn't look like cave people in the car commercials. They were not like that at all.
Talk about the different peoples who inhabited the area and you wrote about in the book.
Well, I know from a lot of the research that's been done that we would have been living in tribes. Now, this is in contrast to the Neanderthal, and the Neanderthal was also on the continent at the same time we were. They were stronger, they were faster, and they had bigger brains, so they might have been smarter than we are. But we prevailed, and they did not, and we think one of the reasons is that they were probably more confined to smaller tribes. When I wrote The Dog Master, I placed it in a time of larger tribes for the humans because that's what the archaeological evidence supports. And of course, we also had this amazing, what I would call it, a disruptive technology. We had the wolf, and that really changed everything for us. So the tribes would have been, in my telling of it, because we don't have any written language to go back on. But I envision that there's a tribe called the Wolfen that follows the wolf, and they're very specifically focused on worshiping the wolf as a religion, and they feed the wolves, which would have been a highly unusual activity for humans because we were starving. We were highly unlikely to give food, such precious food, to the wolves. And then there's the Kindred, which is the largest of the clans, and where most of the action takes place in the Dog Master, where a man is banished for a variety of reasons, including the fact that he has a crippled leg.
We are speaking with W. Bruce Cameron on the Book Report. You know, I loved what you must consider the central question of the book. How did humans go from being preyed upon by wolves to living with them?
That was exactly the whole reason I wrote The Dog Master, was to try to get to the root of this question. Why are we friends with the wolves? What has happened that I have a little dog that sleeps in my bed at night, when if we track this back to the beginning, we would not have been able to sleep at all if we knew there were wolves out there. We would have been awake and alert. That was the turning point in our species, because once we had this wolf by our side helping us hunt, we were much more capable of survival. But it had to be an extraordinary event, because evolution is the water torture of biological processes. It takes forever. And yet, somehow, a person and a wolf came together, and that was what changed everything for us.
You're in Canada, and you're there because a movie is being based on your book, A Dog's Purpose. How are you involved, and what's it like to be there?
It's really fun to be here, to look around and say, wow, when I wrote A Dog's Purpose, I had no idea that someday I'd be standing around looking at what seems to be hundreds of people scurrying here and there, moving things and taking up lights and barking into megaphones and talking on walkie-talkies. It is really fun. My wife and I wrote the screenplay together for A Dog's Purpose, so of course we're very involved in the evolution of the book to screenplay.
And who's starring in the film?
Well, I will have to say that the stars to me are all the wonderful dogs that have been cast in this movie. These are the most wonderful animals. There's this, the dog that plays Buddy, his face is so emotive. When he's supposed to look sad, he looks sad. When he's supposed to be happy, he looks happy. Dennis Quaid and Peggy Lipton are also in the movie. Britt Robertson is in the movie. So those are some of the big name stars that you'd recognize, but I consider the stars to be the dogs.
Huh. And when will we be seeing it at the movie theaters?
Well, it's not locked down, but the placeholder date is sometime in May of next year.
Okay, we'll look forward to it. You've written other books entitled 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter and Marrying My Daughter. How did these books come about?
Well, when I wrote 8 Simple Rules, which became a TV show on ABC, I had teenage daughters, and I felt like I was living in the zombie movie. I would open the door, and there'd be this creature standing there that wanted to talk to my daughter, and it'd be a teenage boy, and he looked like a zombie, and he smelled like a zombie, and he was as responsive as a zombie. And if I made him go away, more would come, you know? It was just, I felt like I was under siege. So I, in defense, started to mull over the fact that if dads were in charge, there would be an entirely different world going on for these young men, and I came up with 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter.
All right, so what's next for you?
What's next is I'm sort of on book tour for The Dog Master and would love to turn that into something like a screenplay or a TV show. So we're currently working out the details for that. And then I've got a couple books going out next year. One of them is a sequel to my mystery thriller, paranormal mystery thriller, The Midnight Plan of the Repo Man. The new one's called Repo Madness. That'll be out middle of next year. And I've also got a story, a children's book based on A Dog's Purpose, called Bailey's Story. There's another one called Ellie's Story, same concept. It takes one of the dogs from A Dog's Purpose and follows their lives.
Well, Bruce, I really enjoyed the book, and I want to thank you so much for stopping by today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye, Bruce.
Bye-bye.
Bruce's new book, The Dog Master, is not yet out in audio. So let's listen to one of his recent titles, The Midnight Plan of the Repo Man. Rudy McCann, former college football star, has experienced a seismic drop in popularity. He's now Kalkasa, Michigan's full-time repo man and part-time bar bouncer. His best friend is his low-energy basset hound, Jake, with whom he shares a life that includes stealing cars. Then, Rudy starts hearing a voice in his head. The voice introduces himself as Alan Lautner, a dead realtor. Is Rudy losing his mind? To complicate matters, it turns out Katie, the girl he's fallen for, is Alan's daughter. When Alan demands Rudy find his murderers, Rudy decides a voice in your head seeking vengeance is best ignored. George Wilson performs this sweet romance-slash-murder mystery featuring a lazy but loyal dog and a town full of nutcases.
Computers and insurance companies call me Ruddick McCann. To everyone else, I'm just Ruddy. I work for a collateral recovery agency run by a guy named Milton Kramer. When people can't make their car payments, I help them get back on their feet. I'm a repo man. Get it? Back on their feet. That was repo humor there. Milton does some financing, mostly people from our small town of Kalkaska, Michigan, who can't get credit anywhere else. But usually our business comes from banks and finance companies. We'll get assignments to repossess folks who can't pay, won't give up their vehicles voluntarily, and who usually hang up on collectors who are calling to try to work something out. It makes collectors mad when you hang up on them, so they pay me to go out and express their displeasure in person. I've been relieving people of the burdens of automobile ownership for more than 6 years, and I still don't understand why it is necessary. If you can't afford to make your car payments, why not just drive it back to the dealership and hand over the keys, instead of making Ruddy McCann come after you? Of course, a better question might be, if you aren't making any money, why don't you move someplace where you can find a job? Most of the time, my customers give the impression that having their vehicles repossessed is far from the worst thing to happen that week. When they invite me into their homes to hear their complaints about life, I have to shed my coat. They always keep it hot, their wood stoves pumping out heat and carbon monoxide in equal measure. Their TVs are always on. The local economy has been stuck in a recession since the term was invented. 9 months of the year, it's cold and wet, and then it turns hot and humid. No rational person would stay here longer than the time it takes to pack up his belongings and leave. I should know. I've lived here all my life. Today I was looking for a 25-year-old man named, of all things, Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein Croft was his full name, though I suspected everyone called him Einstein. How could you resist? He worked on the assembly line at a place called Plasmerc Manufacturing. Something told me he wasn't exactly living up to his parents' expectations regarding his intelligence. Einstein didn't feel morally or ethically bound to pay for his used pickup truck anymore, and had crudely suggested to the woman from the bank that she go somewhere to have anal sex with herself. When I met up with Albert Einstein Croft, I'd ask him to explain the physics of how that was supposed to work. The Plasmerc factory had only been open a few years, and I'd never been there before. I was surprised when I located the place that the employee parking lot was fenced and paved, with a guard and a booth, no less. Most companies in northern Michigan were more considerate, leaving their workers' cars out in the open, where the repo man could easily get to them. I pulled up in Milt's tow truck and nodded at the guard, hoping he'd figure I was from AAA and punch the button for the gate to swing open. Instead, he gave me a stony stare, so I sighed and rolled down my window. "Hey, how's it going?" I asked in what sounded to my ears like a falsely cheerful voice. I'm not really known for doing cheerful. "Help you?" I had to make a quick decision on how to play it. I decided to shrug and look dumb. "Got a call. Guy named Croft, an employee here. I'm supposed to pick up his truck, haul it in." He didn't move to open the gate. "Yeah?" We looked at one another. The guard was my age, around 30, and had my build, solid and big. It was obvious we didn't care much for each other's attitudes. "I know who you are," he said finally. It was my turn to say, "Yeah?" So I did. "You're Ruddy McCann. Everybody used to look up to you, and then you let us down." "Well, sometimes that's how these things go."
We've just heard The Midnight Plan of the Repo Man by W. Bruce Cameron. When a mysterious case of illegal cactus smuggling comes to their attention, canine Chet and his human PI companion Bernie Little find themselves in a prickly situation. With tail-wagging apologies to Jane Austen, sense, as in sniff, and sensibility, is book 8 in Spencer Quinn's best-selling mystery series. As the story begins, Bernie's wall safe is gone, and with it, Bernie's grandfather's watch, his most valuable possession. And next door, old Mr. Parsons is under investigation for possessing a saguaro cactus illegally transplanted from the desert. Is it possible the neighbors, such a lovely old couple, have a terrible secret in their past? Chet and Bertie begin their investigation and discover bad things in the desert, all somehow connected to a strange but innocent-seeming desert festival called Arrow Bright. Jim Frangione narrates.
Iggy's my best pal. Lives next door with the Parsons. The fun we used to have. But that was before the Parsons, a real old couple, bought an electric fence that they never managed to work right. So now Iggy didn't get out much. And even in the old days, had he ever been in our house? Not that I remembered. So what was his smell doing here? Not a faint, long-ago kind of smell, by the way, but strong and recent. I rolled over, popped up on my feet, barked one of my barks, of which I've got many. One or two that can tear the roof off, as Bernie says. The truth is, he only said it once. But it led to a whole night of me trying to bark the roof off where we were, which happened to be a hotel. Possibly the Ritz, where we'd gone for a special weekend with Susie. Susie being Bernie's girlfriend, a crack reporter now working for the Washington Post, which might be in Foggy Bottom. I came real close to figuring out something about the past, but no cigar, which didn't bother me at all. Once I chewed on a cigar butt, and believe me, it's not something you'd want to repeat. Although I did. And then again. Back to this particular bark, not close to my loudest, but sharp and quickly cut off, sending a message. I was about to try it again, even sharper, when Bernie stuck his head in the room. You okay, big guy? There he was. My Bernie. Hadn't seen him in way too long. My tail started wagging, closed in on blur speed. The room got breezy, not sure why. But that breeze carried Iggy's scent. My tail hit the brakes in mid-wag, stood tall and stiff, and I was back to barking that sharp bark, eyes on Bernie. Going through some mood changes, huh? He said, which I didn't get at all. I was about to bark one more time. Bernie, we've got a problem. When he took a gun from his pocket and moved toward the waterfall picture. We'd had several guns in our career, including the .38 Special, now at the bottom of the sea for reasons I couldn't remember even if I tried, which I did not. And for a while, quite recently, we'd been completely gunless. Not good in our line of work. But that .45, a big stopper, in Bernie's hand meant we were good to go again. A big stopper, by the way, that I'd taken off a perp or possibly a cop of some sort. I was wondering about that, as Bernie reached for the waterfall painting. A gun not in use belonged in the safe, where we also kept some papers, plus our most valuable possession, Bernie's grandfather's watch. Bernie removed the painting, spun the dial on the safe, put the gun... But no. What was this? No safe? No safe behind the waterfall painting, but instead just a hole in the wall? Bernie went still. So did I. We're a lot alike in some ways, although the only one actually panting was me. Bernie lowered the painting, leaned it against the wall. He put the gun back in his pocket, all his movements real slow now, his gaze on the hole in our office wall. I could feel his thoughts. He was thinking his hardest. When Bernie thinks his hardest, the air feels like a storm's coming on. Then he gets an idea and you feel light as a balloon when someone lets go of the string. Feeling light as a balloon when someone lets go of the string, Charlie, for example, is the best. I waited as patiently as I could for Bernie to get an idea. All I knew was that Iggy couldn't be the perp. He's way too small, for one thing, and not much of a leaper. Leaping is my best thing, although I'd somehow flunked the leaping test at canine school on my very last day. Was a cat involved? And maybe some blood? It didn't matter. That was how I'd met Bernie, meaning it was the best day of my life, except for all those that followed.
We've just heard Sense and Sensibility by Spencer Quinn. Buster, the dog who saved 1,000 lives, is a London Sunday Times top 10 bestseller. The true story is written by Will Barrow with Isabel George. Thousands of lives have been saved by Buster, an RAF spaniel who served his colleagues and his country with unstinting devotion. Buster served 5 tours of duty, more than any other military dog. This is the story of Buster's partnership with Will, told by Will himself. The story, performed by Gordon Griffin, describes how each came to save the other's life in the dust and desert heat of Afghanistan.
After a short while, we joined Highway 1, a decent proper road by local standards, which encircles Afghanistan. Suddenly, I realized that this was it. I couldn't escape now, even if I wanted to. And I admit that there were times as I packed, unpacked, and repacked my kit for the umpteenth time that I had thought of taking an immediate career break. Okay, where are you, Buster? I pushed my right foot in front of me. It connected with something soft but solid. Buster. Buster didn't like sitting on the floor. In fact, Buster never sat on the floor. He preferred to commandeer a seat next to the guys, not necessarily next to me, I might add. I bent down and whispered in his ear, "Just checking, in case you have found the only clever dick in this sweaty space that has a ham bone or a chew stick about his person. I know what you're like." I ruffled his ears. "You think I'm just a thick human being, but I know what you're thinking. And what's more, I thank God for you, you great daft dog." Those who aren't dog lovers probably think that talking to our four-legged friends is a step too close to crazy. But sometimes there's no better conversationalist than a dog. If you are afraid, they sense it and calm you without uttering a word. If you're making a fool of yourself, they draw you to one side and give you that look that says, "You know, you can be a real prat sometimes." And if you're lost for words, they fill the silence by giving you a big kiss. As Buster leant his warm spaniel body into my leg, I felt a swell of reassurance wash over me. I knew that if I died tonight, I would not be alone, because my best pal would be watching over me. We drove for some time, the light slowly coming up. I was at the back and had a small window to look through. Most of the time there was nothing of interest to see, but occasionally we would pass through a small town. Ping, ping, ping! A hail of metal-on-metal shots splattered against the Viking. Spat, spat, spat! I stayed low and arched over Buster, who was panting like crazy. I put my hand to his chest, and I could feel his heart pounding. For what was probably only seconds, I left my hand where it was, so I would know if he was hit. While I knew in my head that there was no need to worry, as there was no way that normal bullets would penetrate the beast that was the Viking, my heart still made me pull him close to me to protect him.
That was Buster by Will Barrow with Isabel George. Meg Donahue, best-selling author of How to Eat a Cupcake and All the Summer Girls, returns with Dog Crazy, a poignant, funny tale of loss and love. As a pet bereavement counselor, Maggie Brennan uses a combination of empathy, insight, and humor to help patients cope with the anguish of losing their beloved four-legged friends. Though she has a gift for guiding others through difficult situations, Maggie has serious trouble of her own that threatens the success of her counseling practice and her volunteer work with a dog rescue organization. Everything changes when a distraught woman shows up at Maggie's office claiming her dog has been stolen. Searching the streets of San Francisco for the missing pooch, Maggie finds herself entangled in a mystery that forces her to face her biggest fear and to open her heart to a new love. Donna Postal performs the book.
A few nights after euthanizing Celie, her 11-year-old Russian toy terrier, Leanne Hadley had done an internet search using the words dog and death and guilt, and eventually clicked her way to my Pet Bereavement Counseling Practice's brand new website. During our first session, she showed me a photograph of Celie. Russian toy terriers, it turns out, are dainty little animals, short-haired all over, except for the long, crimped hair that trails like streamers from their upright triangle ears. Celie appeared pert and pretty, with a sharp nose and tufts of feathered strawberry blonde hair. Debbie Gibson, I'd thought. Identifying dogs' famous doppelgangers is one of my particular skills. My own dog, Toby, a flat-coated retriever mix, could have been the love child of Elizabeth Taylor, black old Hollywood waves, and Bruce Willis, thick neck, sparkle in the eye. Though in his later years, a strong resemblance to Ian McKellen, gray beard, had emerged. Over the course of our first session, I learned that Celie was an empty nest consolation present from Leanne's husband, Darren, after their youngest child left for college. Whenever Leanne watched television, Celie would leap to the top of the couch and curl around the back of her head, as tight and light as a laurel leaf crown, periodically burrowing her cool, wet nose into Leanne's hair for a good snuffle. In the car, Celie preferred the back seat. Driving Ms. Celie, Leanne joked. She performed a winning tap dance, complete with a crazed, open-mouthed grin, whenever a can was opened in the kitchen, and would sulk below the table for a solid hour if the can turned out to contain something other than dog food. She tolerated Leanne carrying her, but no one else. She had her dignity. Celie's tiny toenails clacking against the hardwood floor, close on Leanne's heels, had been the peppy backbeat of Leanne's life for 11 years. Leanne didn't leave her bedroom for 2 days after Celie died. Her cheeks burned with embarrassment when she told me this. I assured her that her reaction was not uncommon. She wasn't alone. Love is love, I told her, as I tell all of my patients who are ashamed to find themselves shattered by the death of a dog. Loss is loss. She gave me a grateful smile, and I returned it. Now I open my notebook. How was your week? Good, thanks, Leanne says. 30 years have passed since she left South Carolina, but she still has a lovely southern accent, as soft as her round face. Lots of yard work. I pulled the dried-up geraniums out of our patio boxes and planted some of that snazzy horsetail. What inspired the change? She takes a sip of tea, considering. The time of year, I suppose. Spring is on the way, though you sure wouldn't know it from the weather. She looks down into her cup, and a crease forms between her brows. It's hard to believe I've been coming to see you. That Celie's been gone 3 months. It still feels so... She trails off. 3 months is like the blink of an eye compared to 13... I shake my head sharply, correcting myself. 11 years of companionship. Leanne's gaze flits to the rows of framed credentials that hang on the wall behind me. The Bachelor of Arts in Psychology and Masters of Science in Clinical Psychology diplomas, both from the University of Pennsylvania. The row of certifications and licenses from the National Board for Certified Counselors, the American Academy of Grief Counseling, and the Pet Loss Grief Recovery Program. I've noticed the wall is a touchstone for my patients, a reminder of why we're now a part of one another's lives. It's my touchstone, too, though I wait until I'm alone in my apartment to look at it. On the best nights, those diplomas and certifications reassure me that, despite recent developments indicating the contrary, I know what I'm doing, I am a skilled professional.
That was a sampling of Dog Crazy by Meg Donahue. When Martin McKenna was growing up in Ireland in the 70s, he felt the world knew him only as that stupid boy. He was badly understood by his family and his teachers. Martin escaped from endless bullying by running away from home and eventually adopting, or being adopted by, 6 street dogs. Camping out in barns, escaping from farmers, and learning to fend for himself by caring for his new friends, Martin discovered a different kind of language, strict laws of behavior, and strange customs that define the world of dogs. These lessons helped Martin make a name for himself as the Dog Man in Australia, where he now lives. This is an emotional story seasoned with plenty of Frank McCourt-style humor. The Boy Who Talked to Dogs, a memoir, is an inspiration for anyone who's ever been told he or she won't amount to anything. It's also a unique, fascinating look into canine behavior. The book is narrated by Aaron Abano.
Something was covering my face, making it difficult for me to breathe. I jerked up, clawing at my head like a wild thing. But instead of an angry farmer trying to smother me in my sleep as I had just dreamt, it was just a big clump of stupid hay that must have fallen across my face while I slept. My name's Martin. At that moment, I was a 13-year-old Irish street kid who had been secretly sleeping in hay barns to escape the rain and cold for several months. But at least I wasn't alone. 6 dogs had adopted me when I first ran away from home, and they were now following me everywhere. We'd become a gang of strays and the best of friends. Dogs, where are you all hiding? My eyes glanced at the mounds of hay around me. They must still be asleep, I thought. They always tunneled down deep when it was this cold to make a nest for themselves. Icicles hung from the tin ceiling above. The pearly grey light told me it was dawn, so I snuggled back down and pulled a thick layer of hay over myself to keep warm. My breath hung like mist in the air above my face. God, I was hungry. I rubbed my mouth on my sleeve and caught a whiff of myself. Phew! After 5 months of living rough, I was definitely turning feral. No wonder farmers kept chasing me off with shotguns and blackthorn sticks. Who'd want something as wild as me hanging around their farm? I wasn't much to look at, skinny as a whippet, grubby, ears that stuck out like doorknobs, long nose on a long face, bold green eyes that didn't miss much, an insolent mouth that usually got me belted. What instantly set me apart from other kids around Gary Owen, besides the pack of dogs glued to my heels, was my shaggy tangle of mousy brown hair. It looked a bit like a wild hedge, which wasn't surprising, given the fact that it hadn't been touched by soap, a brush, or scissors for months. As for clothes, I was wearing a black duffel coat I'd borrowed from a backyard clothesline, the same dirty jeans I'd run away in, and a scruffy yellow woolen sweater I'd scrounged from a plastic bag at the local dump. Even more precious was a pair of boots liberated from a Gary Owen doorstep. I'd only kicked them off last night because they pinched like a... I started reaching for them, but froze when I heard a creak nearby. It was Sean Moss, the psycho farmer who owned the barn. He was stepping off the ladder onto the loft. His big hobnailed boots were sinking down into hay, and his huge knuckled hands were swinging his weapon, a heavy blackthorn stick, around in lazy circles through the air, the razor-sharp spikes making it whistle horribly. His eyes were nailed to mine. "You again," he growled. "Warned you, boy. What would happen if you came snivelling back round here?" There was no point trying to explain that the heavy rain had trapped us there that night, that I'd been so cold and wet I'd risked sneaking in after midnight. There wasn't a person alive who could negotiate with Sean Moss when it came to protecting his precious territory. Suddenly, He charged at me, swinging his stick high. Thwack! Fortunately, he missed.
"Where are those bloody mongrel dogs of yours?" he roared. "No, they're in here somewhere."
The hay around me erupted as my dogs suddenly burst out. They rushed to stand in front of me in a line, and their barking became frenzied. Sean glared at us.
"Good, got you all trapped."
He raised his stick and took a step closer. The dogs' barks were as loud as gunshots inside the barn. Crouching in the hay, I stared at my dogs in shock. I'd known them for months, but had never seen them like this. Teeth bared, hackles straight up. They stood side by side, facing Sean like the most loyal of bodyguards. If Sean wanted to hurt me, he'd have to get through them first. They were magnificent. First in the lineup was Blackie, a massive beast of a Newfoundland, crouched, ready to attack with huge snapping teeth.
We've just heard The Boy Who Talked to Dogs by Martin McKenna.
For years, Greg Mall struggled to keep the last of his family-run restaurants afloat in Ohio. When it finally closed, Greg was broke and unsure what to do next. Then, a stranded vanload of puppies changed his life forever. Journalist Peter Zutlin's Rescue Road chronicles his travels with Greg from Ohio to the Gulf Coast. Greg brings hard luck dogs from the Deep South to loving forever families up north with the help of scores of selfless volunteers along the way. From Houston's impoverished Fifth Ward, where thousands of strays roam the streets, to high-kill shelters in Louisiana, to joyous scenes of adopters embracing their new pups in the Northeast, Rescue Road is full of heart. Barry Abrams performs this inspiring story.
A few weeks later, my older son Danny, then 21, and I took an outdoor grilling class taught by our friend Chef Chris Schlesinger. He brought along his new black lab, Sal, who was mellow and unobtrusive. A little jolt of envy passed through me, and not because Chris has talents at the grill I can only dream of. It was his bond with Sal. The dog adored him, and vice versa. That, I thought, is a beautiful thing. By the time I came home that evening, my reticence had turned into determination. I said to Judy, "Let's get a dog." We quickly learned that the rescue movement was much bigger than we imagined. Once we started asking, it seemed everyone we ran into with a dog had a rescue, and that the matching of dogs and families largely takes place online. The internet has played a huge role in the growth of the canine rescue movement, especially in pairing and moving thousands of abused, abandoned, and neglected dogs from the South to forever homes in the North. We'll come to the question of why there are so many Southern dogs later. Sites such as PetFinder.com, used by many rescue groups, including Labs for Rescue, are the Match.coms of the canine world. On these websites, eager adoptive families can peruse pictures of countless dogs waiting for their forever homes, read what their temporary caregivers have to say about them, learn what is known about their previous lives, which is usually little, and in some cases, watch a short video showing the dog interacting with people, fetching a ball, or just generally looking absolutely adorable. And this is exactly what we did once our cold war over canines finally ended. When Judy came across Albie online, she thought she'd met the one. In the short video, his eyes were soulful, his tail was always wagging, and he seemed to be pleading for someone to love him. She hurried into my office with her laptop so I could see for myself. Somewhere between 2 and 3 years old, he'd been found wandering, frightened and alone, by a country road in central Louisiana. Now he was in a high-kill shelter in Alexandria, Louisiana. My heart also jumped as I watched Albie, confined in a small, fenced, grassy area, chase a ball and trot back proudly to someone who was off camera, his tail wagging a mile a minute. He was so earnest, so eager to please, and so obviously sweet-tempered. 30 short seconds, and I could already feel myself attaching to this lovable creature 1,200 miles away. Even though I knew it was a huge leap of faith to commit to a dog you only know from watching a video, after all, the video isn't going to show the dog at his worst, just his best, I was smitten. Judy and I emailed Albie's Labs for Rescue adoption coordinator, Kerry Bullock-Toth of the Humane Society of Central Louisiana, who, as you'll see in later chapters, is one of the true unsung heroes of the rescue movement, and asked a few questions to reassure ourselves that Albie was as he appeared in the video. "He has manners," she replied, and verified everything was as it seemed. Thus assured, we set the process in motion, which included a home visit by a local Labs for Rescue volunteer in Massachusetts to ensure we were as responsible as we appeared as well. Reputable rescue groups go to great lengths to try and assure successful adoptions. Some of these dogs have been the victims of unspeakable neglect or abuse. Many have just been the victims of plain old bad luck. When they place a dog, unless it's a temporary foster to get them to a safe place, they are truly looking for a forever home. That's why they also carefully screen the dogs for adoptability and prepare them for their new lives. They assess temperament, and they do everything they can to make sure the dogs are healthy, current on all immunizations and other preventatives, and importantly, spayed or neutered.
That was Rescue Road by Peter Zutlin. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed today's exploration of authors who have a passion for pooches. Certainly, there are some great reads in this pack. To keep current on titles from around the animal kingdom and around the world, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.